Hey, welcome everyone. Thanks for joining to our, once again, to our religious Zionism series. So what I'd like to do today is sort of finish the theoretical, philosophical aspect or survey of religious Zionism so that we have a construct, a framework for exploring some of the specific issues that one encounters as a religious Jew and also in inhabiting a state. And today, I'd like to briefly review what we saw with Rav Kook and sort of that camp, and I'd like to then contrast it to what we're going to see today from Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Reines. So Rav Kook, to summarize it in a word, his view of Zionism is essentially profoundly spiritual and even messianic, such that Rav Kook sees start returning to Israel as a step in the process of history, that the whole world history is coming to a point of climax, of fruition. And by coming back to Israel and bringing secular and religious Jews together, this is a messianic prophecy being fulfilled. The two will fulfill each other. And Rav Kook's idea is that there's sanctity in everything. And so the state is a holy entity in and of itself. And everything in it is holy. And more, further, even the things, the steps in history, which you or I would look at and say, that's bad, that's a negative thing, this is something that we wouldn't have wanted to happen, Rav Kook looks at it and sees that as also a step in the messianic process. So it needed to happen that there would be Jews who did not keep Torah and mitzvot because they have certain ideals that religious Jews wouldn't express, and therefore it's good that they are part of the movement. Even things like war, Rav Kook looks at and sees that they bring out a certain ideal that wouldn't have been brought out otherwise. Everything is sort of seen in retrospect as a part of the messianic process. So on the one hand, that's a very inspiring notion. It's very optimistic. It's very wonderful to think how, yes, everything is going to work out. As Rav Kook says, there's going to be prophecy and we're going to have a Sanhedrin and we're going to solve all our problems and it's just going to be grand. On the other hand, the problem is that in the realistic world, it doesn't always work out the way you want it to. So that it didn't magically happen that all the Jewish people who went back to Israel got along splendidly and got together and made this wonderful, perfect utopian nation. That didn't happen. It didn't happen that Sanhedrin came back or that anyone would even accept the Sanhedrin. And furthermore, a lot of the very practical problems that come about when you're trying that we experience today, when you try to found a state that is both democratic and religious, Rav Kook doesn't really address. He just says it's going to work out because we're going to have a divine inspiration. And furthermore, finally, that the sort of radical vision that Rav Kook paints of the Jewish state results in certain radical elements of society, such that if you say Mashiach is coming, Mashiach is coming, so some people take that and say that means this state right now is a messianic vision, therefore whatever steps I need to take to bring that to fruition, I'm going to. So that means storming the Temple Mount and doing all sorts of destructive acts, if that means conquering Israel no matter what. If it means making all sorts of wild predictions after the Six-Day War, Mashiach is here, and that's why this happened, so be it. And that is a bit of a, I would say, negative aspect of Rav Kook's vision, in that idealism is wonderful, but you need to also be realistic. You need to deal with real-world problems. This Jewish state isn't just an idea, it's also a reality on the ground, and we need to be able to deal with it as the problems arise. So I want to contrast all of that with a different vision of Zionism today, and I think that put together we'll get two different perspectives, and I think these will both together help us deal with some of the issues that we experience today. So I'm going to share my screen. Hopefully you'll be able to see my PowerPoint presentation. We're going to learn about two thinkers today, one of whom I imagine most of you are familiar with, one of whom less so, and that is Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. In a word, Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines was a pioneer of religious Zionism. He founded the Mizrahi movement. Do we know the Mizrahi movement? The Mizrahi is very active today. It's active in Toronto, certainly. Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines was the founder of that movement, and I'd like to learn a bit about what he saw in the Jewish state. First, a bit of a biography. And who, so actually, before I get to that, I want to pull this quote. And I want to bring this to you and hear what you think. So let's read, look, I'm going to read this quote from Raymond Gallwater. It's a very nice book, and he has a chapter on wryness. And I want to hear what you think about it. He says as follows: "It is therefore a paradox that Jacob Wryness, who founded Mizrahi as a religious party within the Zionist movement, rejected the concept central to the thought of Al-Kalai and Kalasher, that the purpose of settling Israel was to establish a self-governing community there in order to bring about the final redemption. Wryness disagreed, believing that the redemption could only come about by divine intervention." Meaning, at the very beginning of our series, we quoted from Rabbi Kalischer, who argues that no, that we can bring about redemption with our activity. We start the process of Mashiach. Rabbi Wryness said, no, that is not true. We are not going to bring about redemption. God brings about redemption. That is not what the state of Israel is about. It is not about the final redemption. For him, modern religious Zionism was a solution to the two great problems that world Jewry faced: assimilation and persecution. Consistent with this view, Wryness was prepared to accept an offer by the British government of a Jewish national home in Uganda. We'll get to the Uganda point at the end of our treatment of Wryness today. My questions to you are twofold. What are your thoughts when reading this paragraph about Rabbi Wryness, this conception of Zionism without any sort of messianic undertones? And furthermore, if it's not about that, if it's not about that per se, if it's not about bringing Mashiach or anything like that, then what is religious about Zionism? What is religious about a political movement? Every nation, you know, what probably would like to have a state. So if it's not about bringing Mashiach, then what are rabbis, religious rabbis, doing involved in a political movement? These are my two questions. What do we think?
I say self-preservation comes before spirituality.
Self-preservation. Very practical, right? So you're saying, Martin says, protecting our nation is a religious goal, right? V'chai b'hem, v'lo sh'yamut b'hem, pikuach nefesh, saving lives is a mitzvah. We can't keep the Torah if we're not alive. Totally a fair point. Anything else? What else would be religious about a movement to bring a nation back to its homeland? Aside from basic survival, what might be, or if I use the word nationalism, I'm going to argue today that Rabbi Ron, as opposed to Rav Kook, who's always connecting the divine idea with the national idea, saying that there's something incredibly deep and profound about nationalism, Rabbi Wryness sees nationalism on a simple level and says that in and of itself is a religious ideal. Nationalism, the movement of a people to establish itself as a nation, is religious.
Maybe,
why would that be?
Maybe it was the strategy to mobilize people, religious and non-religious, because if you frame it as much of a political movement as a religious movement, then you have more uptake in terms of creating the necessary forces to bring the state to fruition.
Right. Beautiful. So that is 100% correct, as we'll see about Mizrahi. Mizrahi specifically in the beginning opposed any cultural or educational programming. They didn't want there to be a Mizrahi educational wing. No, this is political only, for that exact reason. Because once we start talking about education, there's clearly going to be differences between what the Orthodox element of the movement and the non-Orthodox element would prefer.
Rabbi Bergman?
Yes.
If we go back prior to the time of the rabbis, there was a fundamental statement that was made in the Torah, in the Chumash, specifically in terms of the promise of settling the land. There was no prerequisite for that in terms of levels of religiosity or political structure, or so forth. So this Rabbi Wryness may have been just pragmatic enough to see for that realization to happen again.
Right. The mitzvah. It says in the Torah to settle the land. It doesn't, that in and of itself is a goal.
So that maybe you're more than halfway there if that's accomplished.
Right.
But would they have let non-Jews settle in the land as well?
So that's an interesting question that we have to get to. We talk about what it means to settle the land. On a simple level, yes, non-Jews can be allowed, provided they live under certain conditions.
So wait a second. So if you start introducing conditions, Rabbi, as soon as you start introducing conditions, then it's not for the purpose stated.
Not for the purpose stated. Well, yeah,
one of the concerns today is if the Arab population in Israel procreates at the same rate they are procreating now, they all will have a vote and they will, in fact, control the state.
Right. This is a good point. Certainly something that is. So I would argue that this specific vision of Zionism is more vulnerable to that type of concern. That's what I would argue, because if
very much so, very much so.
Rabbi Bergman, further to what Paul is saying, I'm wondering whether or not back in the turn of the last century, when religious Zionism was in its infancy, whether or not anyone could have even anticipated the issues that we're dealing with today.
I don't think they could have. I think that's a fair point.
And nor in terms of what the borders were going to be, who the neighbors were going to be, because the countries that surround Israel today, many of them did not exist at the time of the religious Zionist movement started.
100%. These are all fair points. No one would have known. No one knew what was going to happen. That's 100% true. So let's take a look a little bit at this vision of Baranus, a bit about him. He's a fascinating character, way ahead of his time. There we go. Okay. I got a lot of this content from Mizrahi, also from a few of the books I've read. He's born in Poland in 1840, and like the other Gedolim of his time, an absolute childhood prodigy. He's memorizing tractates, the Talmud, at the age of 10 years old. Imagine that for a second. Full tractates of the Talmud. He wrote numerous works in Talmud and Halacha. What's interesting about him, one thing that's interesting, is that he, from already in that age, he began to develop a knack for secular knowledge. He writes about a mysterious teacher who he doesn't identify, who taught him about mathematics and encouraged him to learn logic. That was not a typical thing at the time. The yeshiva students did not have secular education at all. In fact, they were highly discouraged in the time of the Enlightenment and Haskalah. People were afraid of opening the yeshiva doors to a secular education. But in fact, Rabbi Reines, two times in his rabbinical career, opened a yeshiva that focused on both traditional Talmudic and halakhic study, and also secular education, geography, accounting, languages, and even rabbinic training, right? This is something we take for granted today, but in the old days, yeshiva didn't have rabbinic training. It was you learn, and then you go and take a position someday. But he focused on things like, you know, preparing sermons and what it actually took to be a rabbi. Now, he was a very controversial figure, and he was met with fierce opposition, and the other more, I'd say, traditionally ultra-Orthodox rabbis at the time actually informed the government, and they said they lied that he was doing something against the government. He didn't get the appropriate registration for his yeshiva, and he had to go to jail for 2 days. So this is someone who was a very brave, courageous person that dealt with a lot of adversity. And of course, part of that adversity was the support for the Zionist movement. Already from the time of his youth, his father had a love of Eretz Yisrael, and he was very encouraged by Chibat Sion. Chibat Sion, the movement to establish in the 1800s a few settlements in Eretz Yisrael, he was very encouraged by this movement, even though, again, it wasn't totally religious. Obviously, I'm going to fast forward through his life a bit. I'm not going to cover everything he said, but hopefully you'll get a gist or a taste. So in 1899, he joins Herzl's World Zionist Congress for the Third Congress. And again, this is a very big deal because Herzl, the Congress, was originally totally secular. He's one of the first Orthodox rabbis to join. And not only did he join, but he went about advocating for the movement to other great Orthodox rabbis. Even the Gerer Rebbe, a traditional Hasidic rebbe. He went and pleaded with him about how important it was to join the movement. And unfortunately, or at least, or however you take it, people did not join him. He was generally scorned and his efforts were rejected. And in 1902, and here's the interesting part, he found the Mizrahi movement. Mizrahi means east, but it also meant to stand for Merkaz Ruhani, the spiritual center. This was a faction within the World Zionist Congress that was an Orthodox faction, but it was part of the Congress. It wasn't a separate movement. It was a part of the greater movement. And that's very much a part of Rabbi Reines' vision. In joining this movement, he had to draw a very careful balance between, on the one hand, saying, I'm going to be the religious rabbi who's going to make things religious, who's going to safeguard our religion, who's going to ensure that religion plays a role in the new state, while at the same time keeping the peace, avoiding strife and discord. And for this reason, as I intimated to Robin earlier, he was very adamant at the beginning about discouraging a cultural educational wing. He didn't want Mizrahi to start sort of youth programs and have these educational materials, because he was afraid that that would not be a way to unite. That would only cause discord. They would not be able to agree about how to do it. And therefore he discouraged it. What motivates Reines to join the movement? So as we said, the number one motivation was anti-Semitism. In the late 1800s, there was horrific anti-Semitism. He lived in Russia for most of his life. There was a series of pogroms in Russia from 1881 to 1884. It was very difficult, and this really encouraged him to make a push for the Jewish state. But as I said before, as I intimated, he did not see it as a messianic movement. He did not think that the purpose of this was to bring Mashiach. And this is important, right? Because as we mentioned earlier, there are two primary religious objections to the Zionist movement. One is that it's a secular movement, and we'll get to how we dealt with that in a second. And the other is that it's not upon us to bring Mashiach. That was the theology. God brings Mashiach, and we wait for it. And Rabbi Reines says this, you're right. It is not upon us to bring Mashiach. I'm not trying to bring Mashiach. That's not the point. The point is to get to Israel and protect our nation and ensure the physical and spiritual welfare of the nation. And then hopefully Hashem brings Mashiach. But Mashiach isn't the point. So now what I want to do is I want to focus on a few of his teachings. And I got these from the Mizrahi website. And I'd like to hear what you think about that.
Rabbi, didn't he expect a fight from the Arabs? Did he just expect to walk in and that they would welcome him on a red carpet?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know that he did. At the time, the movement was primarily negotiating with the government of Britain, who was in charge of that territory. So I imagine he was hoping that they would be able to secure a part of the land for the Jews. But it's a good question. I'm not sure about how he envisioned dealing with the Arab nations around. I think Andrew's point's a good one. I'm not sure they really foresaw who their neighbors would be. So here he deals with the notion of yeah, go for it, Andrew.
I'm just wondering if there's anything you've read about the other outlying issues that the Orthodox community had to deal with back around the time of this first Congress that you had put on the slide. Communism was developing, and many disproportionate number of members were Jews who many of them lived in pogroms. The other consideration was by around the same time, the most populated Jewish center in the world was already New York City by the early 1900s. It was larger than any city, Jewish populated city in the world by that time. And it wasn't necessarily a spiritual hub, so to speak. Many Jews from Eastern Europe dreaded the fact that family members would immigrate to the new land. So 100%. Was this really damage control as well?
I think so, yes, specifically, and we'll get to that. I think he saw this as a way of safeguarding the people from assimilation. That if we have our own land and our own nation, that'll be the best way to prevent the people from assimilating and falling prey to some of the temptations at the time, the movements that did exist, and to save them from anti-Semitism. So I do think that it is damage control. So regarding the free thinkers, and I want the secular Zionist movement, I want to contrast it to Rav Kook for a second. So if you remember what we learned, Rav Kook has this movement, this progression. He first is very appalled by the sort of rejection of religion from some of his Zionist peers. He says, this is horrible, they're ruining everything. The next, eventually he sees them as Mashiach ben Yosef, that they're there to safeguard the physical and material well-being of the people. And then ultimately he even sees beyond that there are certain spiritual ideas that only secular people can truly help bring to this new state. Take a look at Rabbi Ryan Assis in terms of uniting with secular Zionists. And I want you to tell me if you think, or what he sees is the justification for doing so. He writes as follows. Yet there are those, this is in a letter he wrote to a friend on Shavasar B'Tammuz, say 150 years ago, or a little less than that. And in this letter, he begins by talking about mitzvot, how there are mitzvot ben adam makom, mitzvot that are between a man and God, and mitzvot ben adam machavero, and mitzvot between a person and God are often not necessarily dictated by reason. Right, we you know, when we take a lulav, you know, there's definitely symbolism there, but I don't know that it's intuitive. Whereas mitzvot ben adam lachavero are intuitive. It's about justice. It's about caring for others. It's about ensuring the community's well-being. And in that context, he talks about certain people who do not generally keep mitzvot adam ben adam lamakom, the mitzvot between man and God, like Shabbat and the like. But they do keep other mitzvot. And then he writes as follows. Yet there are those who depart slightly from God's commandments and permit themselves some leeway in the commandments between men and God because they do not understand. Acting as slaves to reason, they ignore all matters of faith which they cannot comprehend. Yet as for the commandments that seem reasonable, those between men and men, they partake of these and willingly obey them whenever the opportunity arises. Indeed, they fulfill these just as a perfect believers do. The free thinkers, quote unquote, meaning the irreligious, fulfill these commandments because they seem to be reasonable. Their souls ache when others are in trouble. And since man was not created for himself alone, his conscience, that's the typo, excuse me, dictates unselfishness and regard for others. They therefore consider themselves obligated to help the unfortunate and to ease their sorrows whenever possible. That's his vision of the secular Zionist, and therefore concludes, although it is true that the Orthodox obey the mitzvot between man and man with their intentions directly to God and for the sake of the mitzvah alone, nonetheless, basically they're both doing identical things. Would it not be a farce for one to imply the good deeds which the moderns do are of no value and of no merit? The work for Palestine is one of the greatest and most exalted mitzvot. Obviously, he refers to Palestine here, not to the modern-day conception of Palestine, but that's what they called, so it's translated here, there was no state of Israel at the time. One with common sense, feeling, and logical support. For the improvement of the majority is more important than the improvement of the individual conditions. In view of all this, can anything be wrong with helping in the work for Palestine because one's mind and content dictates they help? Is there anything wrong with helping Palestine because it's reasonable to do so? So what is the argument here he's making in terms of working with the secular Zionist movement? What is his justification for doing so on a simple level? Right? When he says that there are people who are concerned about the well-being of the community, the well-being of their fellow person, but they do so for reasonable purposes. It's because they think it makes sense and that that's also valuable, and that the mandate to establish a state for the Jewish people is a totally reasonable mandate, but that's also okay. What's his point? On a simple level, I think what he's saying is it's not, you don't have to look at these people and say, no, really, they're wonderful and it's some sort of divine providence. No, they are who they are, but they have a legitimate desire to help the Jewish community. And just because they're not helping the Jewish community for the reasons that a religious person might, an Orthodox person might, but it's ultimately the same thing of helping the Jewish community. So why wouldn't you unite in that movement? We're all just trying to help the Jewish people here in establishing the state. Why does it matter their goals for doing so? Why would you reject these people's sincere motivations that are on account of reason just because you're saying, I'm doing it because the Shulchan Aruch says to? It doesn't make any sense. And he actually attacks those who oppose him. He says, I don't think they're sincere. I think they're just afraid. I don't think that they really think there's any reason not to join this movement. So the point is very realistic. It's pragmatic. Okay, one person wants a Jewish state because it's good for the Jewish people and it's kindness for the Jewish people. And one person wants it because it's a prophecy in the Torah. Who cares? We both want the same thing. Let's work together. That's the argument. And it makes sense, I think. You don't need to go rationalizing these people's evil deeds or think that there's some divine providence that's motivating them. That's not the point. The point is, let's work together.
But you work together for the formation of the state. But what happens when the state is formed? Who controls the laws of the state and who controls the actions of the people, what you can and can't do? That's where the difference lies.
You're right. And I think he would say, we'll have to work it out. We'll have to have discussion. And, you know, and I think he set his part of his motivation, Paul, is that he wants Orthodox rabbis involved in the movement so they can advocate for religious causes. And then the secular will have a different opinion and you work it out.
Right. That's why we have 79.
I don't think he's ignoring.
But that's why we have 79 political parties in Israel today.
Right. It's not simple. I don't think his point was it's simple, but his point was it's going to save us from getting killed. And it's going, and ultimately, whatever the problems arise, I think that's the next point. Ultimately, whatever problems will exist, there will be problems, but it's going to be better than it would be if we didn't have a state. Because whatever, you know, the conflicts exist in a Jewish state, it's not going to be as bad as the conflicts that exist in living in a Russia where people are getting pogromed every day, right? I think that's his point. I think you're right. I think Rabbi Radish would say you're right. But he was keenly aware of the fact that they didn't agree with him, and that's why he was negotiating. And his point was, when certain things went wrong, he was saying, look, if you rabbis had joined me, maybe we could have made a difference. Maybe if there would have been a stronger religious voice, it would have gone differently. Now, take a look here what he says about the notion of the return to the state of Israel and the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And again, and think about this in contrast to Rav Kook's motivation. I just want to read a little bit more of a Rana, so I'll take some questions because we have to get to Rav Soloveitchik. It could be we'll have to wait for next week for that.
What about Reines in terms of how he dealt with the Lo'alalu Bechoma?
Don't go okay, up, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We have to get to the three oaths. We have to get to the three oaths. It's a good point. We have to get to the oaths. And maybe that's what we'll do after we finish this. But let's focus now just on the philosophical ideology. So look what he says here. One of the basic foundations of our faith is the belief in the return of Israel to its land. Why? Why return to our land? For it is not possible to conceive that our nation is meant to be scattered and separated forever among the other nations in the world without its own land. Therefore, nationalism is the first and basic part of the faith of Israel. For a unique people with its unique religion can only be fulfilled at the time when it has its own land, or at the very least, a hope that it can return to its land.
But that could have been Uganda.
Oh, we'll get to Uganda. We'll get to Uganda. So let me make the point. Let me make the point that it could have been Uganda. This, you're right. he's arguing that nationalism in and of itself is a religious goal, because we can't be who we are meant to be if we're simply dispersed throughout many countries. Then you won't have a real feeling of Jewish identity, because you know wherever you are, you're obviously going to be exposed to all sorts of other ideals. But you make a good point, Paul. Now, I think one response to that is there's also a separate mitzvah of settling Israel specifically. But you're right. This vision is not necessarily unique to the land of Israel. And look at how he I want to contrast another thing here. The way that Rav Kook and classical, or not classical, sort of the camp of Rav Kook, the Messianic Zionist camp, would look at events, you know, the sort of events happening, a new prospect for a state, they would see it in terms of now Mashiach is finally here, the prophecies are coming true. Take a look at what he sees in these sort of things happening. The belief that Israel will return to its own land originates with the inherent relationship between Israel and the land, and with the promise that the Holy One, blessed be he, will give the land to his children. Such a belief instills a strong feeling of belonging between Israel and the land. Each and every Jew should consult his heart and recall all that has passed and occurred to our fathers in this land, and how they sacrificed their lives and their blood was spilled like water upon it. Can such things not light his soul like burning coals and his heart with fire? So here, he speaks of a love for the land of Israel. And he speaks of how historically our ancestors, our great-grandmothers and great-grandfathers sacrificed to get to the land. But it's a historical connection. He doesn't speak of, wow, this is amazing because Mashiach is coming. He speaks of, this is amazing because we've given up so much for this land, and now we actually get to experience it, right? And the way he looks at the commandment to settle Israel is also within this vein. The sages have a notion that the commandment to settle Eretz Israel is equal to all the other mitzvot, right? And it's an incredibly important mitzvah. Why? So you could give all sorts of philosophical and spiritual explanations as to why. He has a more basic one, which is consistent with his conception of nationalism. He says the commandment of settling Eretz Yisrael, which is one of the commandments of God, which cannot be measured in value, has been the subject of hundreds of statements, maybe our sages, in regard to the elevated holiness of the land. And it is as well a commandment in which our intellectual and emotional beings find fulfillment. Furthermore, in regard to the intellect and emotion, there is probably no other commandment of such worth. Why? What's so special about settling Eretz Yisrael? For it is commanded in regard to the general population for the good of the individual and to benefit and improve the condition of the masses, as it is beneficial for each individual. For this reason, the commandment to settle on the land is far greater than all the other commandments, as it affects all actions between man and his fellow man to improve the personal lives of each individual. What's his argument for the importance of settling in Israel? It's going to make our lives way better. It's going to help us take care of each other way more effectively. That's the greatness of it. It will help you do all sorts of acts of kindness and charity. We'll be able to help each other more. We're all in one place, or many of us are in one place, and we have our own state. But there's nothing, he quotes the sages about the elevated spiritual status, but his emphasis is not that. It's not that Eretz Yisrael is so holy. It's that when we go to Eretz Yisrael, we'll be able to help each other. Now, as has been mentioned a bunch of times, this is a bit interesting in terms of Eretz Yisrael specifically. It does leave open the question, if it's all about nationalism, why does it need to be Israel? And that relates to the next point. So I believe it was the 5th Zionist Congress, it might have been the 4th, I'm not sure, I'm forgetting right now, but there was a proposition from the government of England. They offered the Congress plots of land in Uganda. And this was a motion discussed at the Zionist Congress. Now, I would have thought, just naturally, that certainly, there's no way that any of the Orthodox rabbis would agree to such a motion, because What do you mean? Eretz Israel, it's the land of our forefathers. It's in the Torah. It's promised to us. How could you give up on that? And Rabbi Rinas didn't give up on it, but he also didn't reject it. It was a very difficult decision for him whether to back the motion or not. And he weighed the possibilities because on the one hand, and he made the point to those who we argued with, he said, I think you're prioritizing the land over the people. Meaning, of course, ultimately we want to get back to Eretz Israel. But right now, we're in trouble. Right now, there are pogroms going on. Right now, our people are suffering. People are dying. So we had to focus on saving our people. That is the first priority. And if there's a way we can do that in Uganda, then we'll do it there.
And who lived in Uganda? Who lived in Uganda?
I don't know. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. And whether there would have been opposition or not, I'm sure there would have been. I don't think it's ever simple for a government to give a land to another people and say, here, it's yours. And people are just going to say, sure, why not enjoy?
No, the point I'm making is, would the same problems have arisen if we were looking to Uganda then had arisen to Israel?
Partially, I don't think so. I say that because I'm not sure how hotly contested a land Uganda was. I'm not sure. I don't know that any other religions claim that it's their, you know, one of their holiest religious sites. But it's a good question. I'm not sure. That's the honest truth. But I think the bottom line is let's safeguard and secure a people. So I just want to read this.
Bergman.
Pause for questions. 1 second. Take a look what he says here. He agonized over this issue and discussed his doubts and fears and feelings in a letter to Israel Zangwill, who he writes to, an Anglo-Jewish novelist who had founded a Jewish territorial organization to arrange for the emigration of Jews from countries in which they were persecuted to different areas around the world, in a lot of areas. After much debate, Rinas addressed the Mizrahi organization in tears, urging the group to vote for the proposal as it would provide immediate relief to destitute and persecuted Jews. He made it clear he did not intend to cease to struggle for Eretz Israel as a permanent home for the Jewish people. So he sees Israel as important because, of course, Yishuv Eretz Israel is important, and it's in the Torah, and it's in Tanakh, and it's our heritage. But he thinks there's another more important goal, and that is keeping our nation alive and functioning. And therefore, he prioritized accepting the motion to move to Uganda. Obviously, Cook would never, like, even the thought of this would have driven him absolutely nuts, right? But I think it's important to note that this wasn't because Rinas was just, you know, rejecting the goal of moving to Eretz Israel. He just didn't see it as the be-all and end-all. It wasn't the most important thing. And I think this relates to questions we have nowadays, where even if I believe, and I do, that it is our right and our heritage to inherit the land of Israel, but I don't need to put that right above all other things. And I don't need to necessarily always risk people's lives for that right or create all sorts of political conflict or start all sorts of wars. Obviously, each situation has to be weighed appropriately, but there are other considerations. So that, we'll stop here for now with Rabbi Rinas. I have 10 minutes left to maybe start with Rabbi Salvation, but I don't want to stop for questions. If anyone has any, someone raise a... Okay.
Rabbi Bergman.
Yes.
In response to Paul's inquiry, at the turn of the century, Uganda was part of the British Empire. There was a significant migration from what is today India, Pakistan and Bangladesh. And people had been there and settled there for a number of generations. And they only started leaving those elements of the community back in the late 60s. So
do you think it would have been peaceful if the Jewish people had decided to move there or not?
No, not at all. Because what happened ultimately happened to the people from India would have happened to the Jewish population as well.
Right. And you know, I don't believe that wherever we move, people are just going to say, sure, guys, come and join. It's yours now. I just don't think that's going to happen. So I don't think that's the point. But it was a place, at least. It was something. The Britain didn't offer them Israel yet. They offered them Uganda. Right. So I think that's the point. Okay. So let's begin looking at Rabbi Soloveitchik's work. Yes. Yes, Martin.
Yeah, I was saying that Israel would probably welcome even Arabs if they admitted to peace. If they would say, "Yeah, you want us to be peaceful? Give us your land." In other words, they would have to recognize a Jewish state. If the Arabs recognize the Jewish state, I bet there are plenty of Jews who would go along with that, giving them a place in the land.
Right. I want to stay out of that particular, obviously, the very loaded issue right now as we speak. I think you're right. I think you're also, for some people, you're not right, to be honest. I think there are some Jews who want...
The point is, you see...
...totally Jewish.
No other nation would do that. You were saying that probably no other nation would do... No nation would do that. But the one nation...
Oh, that's what you mean. Yeah, you know what? I think you're right. And the fact that we pulled out of Gaza, you know, I'm not going to say it's horrible to live in Gaza, but the fact that we pulled out our own people from Gaza, I don't know if there's a precedent for that. But I don't really want to get into that discussion right now. We could talk about it more when we talk about land for peace and things like that.
Right.
So let's begin for a few minutes. So this, to begin, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Hopefully we're familiar with whoever the Rav or Joseph Rashaber Soloveitchik was. Very briefly, he was an incredible prodigy and genius, both in terms of his Torah knowledge and in terms of philosophical knowledge. He did not grow up in the Zionist movement. He grew up as part of a very prominent rabbinic family in Brisk, a very ultra-Orthodox family, a rabbinic dynasty. But around the time of World War II and further, he realized the importance of the Zionist vision, and it really, you know, it earned him the ire of his family, such that throughout his life, everybody acknowledged his genius and how brilliant he was, but he always got opposition and flack for some of the decisions he made in terms of going to Yeshiva University and becoming a prominent rabbi there in terms of opening up co-ed school, and of course, in terms of his very outward Zionistic outlook. But so I think what I'd like to show, and we'll do most of it next week, I believe, what I'd like to show is that Rabbi Soloveitchik is along the lines of Reines, but more. Whereas I think Rabbi Reines sees nationalism as an ideal unto itself, Rabbi Soloveitchik also isn't going to argue that Mashiach is coming, but he doesn't think it's sufficient to simply argue for a nation state. That's not enough. And with that, I'll begin at least his speech here. So this is actually very recent. We have the opportunity. This is actually very recent that we have the opportunity to look at this. The speech we're about to read was just published in Tradition Magazine, the rabbinic, the RCA's periodical that comes out every season, just published this speech. A Rabbi Soloveitchik, which was originally given in Yiddish. When did he give the speech? In 1948, June 1948. So right after the founding of the State of Israel. And this is to Mizrahi. And he opens his address with a description. It's a sermon, essentially, a speech to Mizrahi. He talks about their mission now that we have the state. What is Mizrahi's mission now? And part of his goal is to show, do not think for a second that now that, please God, and at that time, they didn't know what would happen. It was at the beginning of a war. But now that we have the state, don't think that our job is finished. In fact, it is just getting started. And he opens with a description of a very mystical concept known as Shechinta Begaluta, the Shechina in exile. And what's fascinating is, you read the beginning, you think he's going to go all spiritual and Kabbalistic. It's not so. He asks the following question. We must, however, be focused not upon this cosmic, mystical idea, which the Kabbalists introduced into the Jewish world, the notion of the God's divine presence in exile with the Jewish people. Don't think of the Kabbalah, the mysticism behind that. Rather, we should instead limit ourselves to this idea's logical, practical implications. What does Shechina in exile mean? What do we mean in Chazal, in the sages, when we say it all the time, that when we're in exile, God's divine presence is also in exile? And look what he writes here, and I'll leave you with this quote. In exile, even in the most religious and ideal circumstances, even when the Shekhinah does not become impure, she contracts and is reduced. Meaning, even if everything is great religiously in exile, we have yeshiva, we have all sorts of wonderful religious institutions and Beit Midrashot and synagogues and study halls, there's something missing. The divine presence contracts. This contraction is due to the fact that man lives not only within his own private domain, but is also part of a society and a community. The more life becomes modernized, the more constrained the domain of his intimate private life, while conversely public social life expands. Piety in countries where one is a minority means being pious only in one's private personal life. Shabbat, family, purity, kashrut, etc. Surrounded by the curtains of one's home sanctuary, we can be very religious in our space. It is completely impossible to represent such a life as an embodiment of a full and complete Torah. My social economic existence is linked to the general political economic structure, which is based on other principles. As such, it does not embody my social, political, or legal relationships with society. Whether I sin or not is an entirely different question. The entire complex of my external interactions with society is divorced from Judaism. Shechita Begaluta for Rabbi Soloveitchik means that we can't see the full expression of what it means to be a Jewish people and Jewish society publicly, that we're constrained. We can keep the Torah in our homes. We can pray in our sanctuaries and our synagogues. And he doesn't mean that they're going to be mean to us, mind you. The point is that our politics and our courts and our laws and our interactions are primarily not religious. They exist within a different secular construct. And it is upon us to adapt to that construct as best as we can. And the question that Rabbi Soloveitchik is going to have to answer for us next week is, what is the state of Israel going to do about this? And he's not going to say it's all going to be perfect. He doesn't say, well, now we have a state, everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be according to the Torah. No, he says the opposite. We have to make sure that our state represents our ideals as accurately and sincerely as possible. So we'll pick up with that next week. Please God, and Ritz Hashem. Hopefully we'll have a chance in the coming weeks to get to some of the practical issues that I haven't mentioned. I do want to get to them. We'll start with the three oaths and how we interpret the Gemara, which suggests we shouldn't go back to Eretz Yisrael. We'll talk about things like what our responsibility is in terms of conquering the land and settling the land and running and having sovereignty and things like that. But for now, we'll pause here. Thank you very much. And have a wonderful night, everyone.
Rabbi, next week, why don't you start at 7:20 if you have to finish it?